Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to some poets who are going to be reading at the Center for Contemporary Arts. Ann Waldman will join us, and Margaret Randall will join us as well. Right now, I would like to welcome, because Veterans Day is coming up, two veterans, Ken Mayers and Daniel Craig from Veterans for Peace. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. Always a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you back. It's been a while since you've been on the show. What is Veterans Day? Why do we celebrate it? When did it start?
Veterans Day is actually the renaming of an older observance called Armistice Day. And Armistice Day was created to observe the end of the war, which was supposed to be the war to end all wars, World War I.
That didn't work out so good.
It certainly didn't. We have Veterans Day exactly when we have it because it was decreed that the war would end at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918.
Now, who decreed that? Some numerologist?
The negotiating powers who negotiated the armistice, Britain, France, and the United States, and Germany, said that's when the war ends. And people were killing each other right up to that 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. So Armistice Day was created really to promote peace, to make the war actually be the war that ended all wars. It obviously failed in that respect, but the observance continued. It actually didn't become an officially proclaimed national holiday until the mid-30s. And then in 1954, coincidentally, just a month or two before I took my first oath to uphold the Constitution, it was changed to Veterans Day by an act of Congress.
And so how do we celebrate it? Did we celebrate it in the past and now?
Well, locally, the way it's being celebrated and has been for a number of years by the city of Santa Fe is a parade on Veterans Day. And I think traditionally it's fallen on the weekend, rather than if it's been a weekday in the middle of the week. This year is our second annual invitation as Veterans for Peace to join the parade, and it's comprised of veteran organizations and I think some individual veterans who want to participate in the commemoration. VFW, VFP, I think DAV has a group. Disabled American Veterans,
okay.
DAV. I found it interesting when I thought about it earlier, a few months ago when we got the invitation to join, that parades are usually held and the people being honored are sitting in the stand watching the parade go by, and this is a little different, whereas in honoring veterans, we're the parade itself.
The people who are being honored are the ones who are marching.
Exactly. I'd never thought of this before until we got involved. And then following that, there's going to be a memorial service and some speeches made at the Veterans Memorial there on Galisteo near the Bataan Building. There'll be, the mayoral issue of proclamation. I think potentially Governor Richardson might be there. He was last year.
So how are veterans doing these days? They're being honored on Veterans Day. How are they faring? I know that there's problems of homelessness and problems of services.
Not good. Veterans are not doing very good.
Really?
There was a report that just came out on the AP that veterans make up 1 in 4 homeless in the United States right now.
Are those predominantly Vietnam veterans?
By the numbers, yes. They're mostly Vietnam veterans. But there's a great concern that the numbers of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans that are now becoming homeless is a higher proportion than it was in the years immediately following service in Vietnam. Generally speaking, for whatever reasons, and they haven't entirely figured this out yet, the surge of Vietnamese veterans who became homeless started about 10 years after their service. But we're starting to see Iraq and Afghanistan veterans in increasing numbers entering homeless shelters and requiring community services and so forth.
Mm-hmm. That same report has it that 20 years ago the VA's numbers said that on any given night there were 250,000 homeless veterans. And just 2005 numbers, out of the 745,000 homeless people, 195,000 of those are veterans.
That's on any given night.
2005.
That's on any given night here in the United States.
Yes, that's correct.
What does it look like in Santa Fe?
I haven't seen any numbers on Santa Fe. Back last December, on what certainly felt like the coldest night of the year, whether it was or not, we had a sleep-in just a couple of blocks from here, corner of Cerritos and St. Francis, to dramatize the plight of the homeless. And
what did you do?
We slept on the sidewalks. There were several of us who slept on the sidewalk all night, besides the ones who actually are homeless.
Did it work?
I don't think so, frankly. I don't think it created much awareness. But you
probably
know,
people didn't really notice since it was dark and cold. And
that's certainly a part of the problem. It did get some press coverage, and it certainly brought home to those of us who participated the plight that a lot of our fellow vets have. But it's interesting that over history, the United States has never treated its veterans worth a damn, except following World War II. But from the Revolutionary War onward, there was a fair amount of lip service paid, but in terms of actually thinking about what war does to people, what war does to both veterans and other victims of war, not much gets invested in healing those problems. And it was true, you know, gave rise to Shay's Rebellion after the Revolutionary War. After World War I, veterans were denied their benefits and camped out on the Mall in Washington, D.C., and were eventually driven off the Mall by the U.S. Army under the command of Douglas MacArthur and Dwight D. Eisenhower. So that it seems to be part of our tradition that veterans are honored by lip service, but not by real service.
What about World War II? Why was that different?
Interesting. World War II, of course, there were 12 million veterans. We've never had anything like that. There were 12 million veterans who were all going to be released at about the same time. There was a huge concern that this was going to create an army of the unemployed that could generate tremendous civil unrest and so forth. So in terms of enlightened self-interest, the Congress was amazingly enlightened at that point about what needed to be done and created an extremely generous GI Bill, which included both college benefits. GI Bill would pay full tuition at any college in which you could gain admission. Plus, it paid, I believe it was $52 for 52 weeks a year for 4 years. But at any rate, it gave rise to the greatest surge of college enrollments, as you can imagine, in the world. Plus, they had very generous loan terms for houses. So it led to a huge construction boom. Most of suburbia was built on the basis of VA loans after World War II, so that the veterans were
an ambivalent legacy.
Yeah, but it was amazing when you look at it. There were millions, literally millions of people who got their college education and got home ownership after World War II who otherwise certainly wouldn't have.
Whereas now I know people personally who were actually promised college benefits and then did not receive them. I don't know how common that is.
I don't know how common it is. I can speak from personal experience that I enlisted in 1980 while I was still in high school. And I actually tried to enlist when I was 16 and didn't realize until they told me, no, that you can't do that. But I signed up for the GI Bill in 1980, or 81 when I went on active duty. I got out in 1984. My first tour on active duty went down to New Mexico State to study, going to university. I go to the VA office and find out I have no money. And it turned out, unbelievingly, that my recruiter had lied to me.
No.
I signed up for a program here in the U.S. The U.S. is split up into four quadrants, and they were doing a test program in each quadrant for, you know, college money for enlistees. And it turns out he had enrolled or enlisted me in a program that was not part of the southwestern part of the United States. So therefore, it wasn't valid that I received money. I went to local congressmen, and they did an investigation. The Attorney General of the U.S. Army did an investigation, and I met my obligations, basically my 3-year tour on active duty. And so they basically made the United States, between the VA and the U.S. Army, live up to their obligation and provide me my GI Bill. But it took going to Congress, to a congressman, to get that done. And that's a pretty common story. It's not widespread.
And not everybody succeeds either.
Right. I was fortunate. I started school and had to pay cash for my first semester in school because there was just no GI Bill available till after they were held accountable. And that's a big selling point for recruiters is we provide X amount of money for school. We talk to kids on a fairly regular basis about this. It's like when you sign the contract, know what the contract states.
Read it.
Right, you know, because you're obliged to live up to that contract.
And keep a copy of it.
Yep. The military's not obliged to keep up their end of the bargain. So it's really important. We never tell kids not to join. We tell them this is a business contract you're signing. If it were a civilian job, same thing, you would read the contract, know what you're signing up for.
Now hang on, you just said that they are not obligated to hold up their end of the contract, but we are?
Yes.
How does that work?
That's it. At the bottom of the contract, what it says is that the government may change the terms of this contract because of changed circumstances. So in other words, you're bound. It's not. No, it's not. It definitely isn't. It's indentured servitude is what it is.
Based on the needs of the military, whatever branch of service you're in, based on the needs of the branch of service, you can be reassigned in your MOS to fill that need.
MOS.
Military Occupation Specialty. It's your job description, you know, infantryman, computer operator, mailroom clerk. You have a number assigned with it. If they need grunts or artillerymen or tankers, you know, armor, you're no longer working on a computer in an office. You're sitting in the hatch of an M1 Abrams tank as a loader or a gunner, just like that.
What are your best memories, Daniel Craig, of your military service?
Probably jump school.
Really? Jumping out of planes?
Yeah. I went to Fort Benning for the jump school. It was all the stuff they promise you. Fun FTA. Fun travel and adventure.
Fun. Jumping out of planes is remarkably fun. It's very strange. What about you, Ken Mayers?
Well, actually, I had nothing but good deals from the Marine Corps. It wasn't the Marine Corps that forced me to become what I am today. It was American foreign policy. Because Marine Corps paid my way through college. Marine Corps showed me the world. The Marine Corps educated me in a number of ways. I spent a year at Chinese language school. So that I had lots of good memories of the Marine Corps, and I have lots of respect for my Marine Corps colleagues, who are a terrific bunch of people.
Were you in combat?
I was what my troops would refer to as a RIMF.
What's
which
that?
Stands for Rear Echelon, and I'll leave it to the audience to figure out what the MF stood for. But no, I had, in my last tour of duty, I was a company commander of Company of Communications Intelligence Marines and had detachments of my Marines, 3 locations in Vietnam. And I go down to visit them, but I was never actually in combat. I could see combat from a distance. I was not a frontline shooter.
So what is it for each of you to be, on the one hand, you know, in certain ways indebted to your time in the military, especially you, Ken Mayers, and also really taking a protest stand as you do?
Well, basically what I always say is that Veterans for Peace is an organization largely of people who found out the hard way that serving their government is not always serving their country. So that my protest certainly isn't against the troops who find themselves doing things they never believed they would have done. My protest is against government policies that have them doing those things. And I find it entirely consistent, because the one oath we all took, whether in the service, in the Congress, the President, the oath we all take in common is to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I think I'm doing a much better job of it now than I did when I was wearing my uniform.
What about you, Daniel Craig?
I concur. The part that you just said that keeps striking me over and over again, against all enemies, foreign and domestic, I consider some of our domestic enemies as great a threat, if not greater, than some of the foreign enemies at this point in time.
For example?
Well, if you look at what the Patriot Act has done to this country, and this is just my opinion versus I'm speaking for anyone else besides me. I'm looking at what the Soviet Union was doing while they were the Soviet Union. You know, the
locking spy, people up in the gulag.
Spy versus spy. You know, your neighbor, you say something and you're reported by your neighbor because it might be subversive. Which in many cases, given the direction our government is going, that's not a bad thing. But our work is...
What do you mean that's not a bad thing?
That people are subversive. You know, the dominant paradigm is, for many of us, I mean, like Ken said, we learned the hard way that things are not as they always appear to be, and things are not really okay. A lot of people sacrificed in the name, for what we were told was, in the name of this country, and it was not for the good of the country, it was for a certain section of society in the country. But that's the unfortunate thing about Veterans Day. It doesn't fall at the beginning of summer. So it's just not really widely observed. It's mentioned in the news, no doubt, and thank you very much for having us here today to talk about this. But veterans, I look at what happened in New Orleans with Katrina. They're just not thought of anymore. The people in New Orleans who got displaced in the six figures.
Were veterans?
Well, not all veterans, but I'm just looking at it's analogous. What they experienced, veterans have experienced, you serve your country, your government, and you get out. And then, I mean, it's really not a segment of society that gets a lot of support from the general society.
When is the parade this weekend, and how can people participate in Veterans Day?
The parade begins at 10 o'clock. At the Masonic Temple.
On what day?
On Sunday the 11th.
Okay.
And the parade should take about an hour or so that the observance at the Veterans Memorial, the Bataan Memorial, can begin roughly at the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month. And the route will go from the Masonic Temple down Washington Street to the plaza, around the plaza, and then I forget which one of the streets it takes over to
the Masonic Temple, being the pink one?
The pink, yes. Palace, right.
I think it goes down, it eventually ends up going down Galisteo, because it ends up right there at the memorial in front of the Bataan building.
And there's usually a fair number of people along the parade route. There are a variety of elements in the parade. It's not just veterans. I think there's some school organizations and probably some teams and so forth. So it's a general community event.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here.
Can I put in a plug?
Yes.
At 1 o'clock on Veterans Day on Sunday on this radio station, Daniel and I will be the guests of the Living on the Edge radio program.
Excellent. Well, Ken Mayers and Daniel Craig, thank you so much for being with us.
You're
they
welcome.
Are represent thank Veterans you. For Peace and are talking about Veterans Day, and we will see you on Sunday.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with poet Ann Waldman. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Ann Waldman. She is a poet, performer, professor, cultural activist. She's the author of numerous books of poetry, and her latest book is called Outrider. She will be speaking and actually reading with poet Margaret Randall, who's going to be on the phone with us in just a little while, on Thursday. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Moving Image Lab at the Center for Contemporary Arts. And she will also be giving a lecture on Friday at noon. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
The latest book, titled Outrider, The whole first section of the book is about what the word outrider means. What does outrider mean?
Well, actually, this was an interesting process. J.B. Bryan, the publisher, who's based in Placitas in Albuquerque, who published this book, La Alameda Press, was curious about this term, which I use in relation to the poetics of the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado.
Where you teach.
Where I co-founded the program with Allen Ginsberg. Right now, I'm basically there in the summers, overseeing the summer writing program, and then I teach intermittently during the year. But I'm also based in New York and traveling around the world quite a bit, so I'm not there full-time. But it's a term we've used, which refers to being outside the academic mainstream and outside the official verse culture world, and championing a more experimental poetics. And
now, is there a non-experimental academic poetics that you're contrasting that to?
You could say there's still, well, there's a lineage of, you know, left-hand margin, things that look like poems, writing more for the page, a tradition coming out of the sort of master canon of English literature poetry, which is fantastic. But at a certain point, I think there was I was always interested in the cultures and practices and poetries of Asia, for example, or South America, more you could call it ethnopoetics, tribal poetics, investigating the oral roots and the more shamanic possibilities of activating energy in the public sphere. So I think with Charles Olson's sense of projective verse, projecting it into the, that the poem can be a kind of rite in a public space, that he used the term high energy construct.
Now, projection means you're saying it out loud.
Yes, but you're also, there's something that you're into the future, possibly. It's a way of talking about a poetics of kinetics and interaction and energy. And when we founded something called the Poetry Project in New York City at St. Mark's Church on the Lower East Side in the mid-60s, that was very much a view of, how to engage community in a more collective sense of creating zones, poetry zones for activity and performance. And of course, then that was somewhat of a new view, the poem in the public sphere.
So back to the term outrider.
Okay, well, I think there's one definition which refers to the folk who would ride on their horses, with the cavalry or whatever, the people who delivered the mail. And because the Kerouac School is situated in the Rockies, we're out west on the high energies of the Rocky Mountain air and negative ions. It was a playful term. And rather than outsider, which suggests something more hermetic in a way, or outside the culture, I think it was it's a way to talk about also certain figures, a poet like Loree Nitecker, which some people have heard of, who was associated with the Objectivists, poets like Charles Reznikoff, the Jewish diaspora poets. The lineages of the New American Poetry, of course, include the Black Mountain School, the what's referred to as the New York School of Poets, Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery and others, the Beat literary generation with Ginsberg and Corso and Burroughs and Kerouac, and then the San Francisco Renaissance, and the Black Arts Movement. Of course, the great poet in that world is Amedee Baraka. So these were not, when I was coming of age as a writer and a younger writer, I was very taken with going out to the Berkeley Poetry Conference in 1965, very taken with the writing of those, that this particular nexus, that I've just these different schools. There were poets out of these communities at that event, and it was very different from what was going on in the East Coast. I would say I grew up in New York City, and a sense of a control of the, you know, we call it the East Coast literary mafia. Anyway, I mean, these are just, you know, handy terms that can rally some energy. They're not fixed, and I don't mean to, you know, this is not something I dwell on in terms of compartmentalizing.
Well, the East Coast literary mafia, I mean, there's a certain freedom that I think a lot of us who have moved from East to West feel, and it's a little hard to describe what the nature of that freedom
exactly.
is, but there's something about that you must have...
Well, it used to be uptown, downtown, and of course when we were so active during the Vietnam War period in the Lower East Side, below 14th Street was usually the divide. and then the country, and it would seem very male-dominated, the control of the certain magazines or the prizes or the reading series.
Well,
and there weren't a lot of public spheres. So when we created the Poetry Project with a grant from the Office of Economic Opportunity under Lyndon Johnson, the view there was to work with alienated youth on the Lower East Side. That's a very interesting legacy of those years.
How'd that work out?
Well, we had some money for about 2 years. I mean, very little money. I think we were paying our writers maybe $25, $50 for readings. But we also had workshops that were free. Everything was open to the public. And then that evolved into, you know, conferences and series and, huge range. There's a fantastic archive, and that program still goes on.
Alienated youth. Alienated adults. I mean, this is the subject of poetry.
Well, the community at St. Mark's was very intergenerational, and the community at Naropa is also intergenerational. I mean, people of all ages and ilks come to our summer writing programs.
I think
just alienated from the situation we're all living under, the psychological operation of the policies of this government, I think are very hard and also a challenge.
Well, there's a very interesting combination that I was reading in your work of, you know, Buddhism, poetry, commentary, essay, politics, sexuality, exploration of all kinds. And there's this question, I can't remember where it is, somewhere toward the beginning of the book, but the question arises, what do poets know? And I thought that was an intriguing question.
it's a constant question. There are jokes about poets doing science or poets the way poets work with the data, with the information, with the... And the term is actually investigative poetics. I mean, that's a term we've been using for a decade or so.
Really?
And in fact, a lot of the projects I'm involved with have to do with, you know, some research and in my travels and encounters, taking notes and, tracking the planet Jupiter, I mean, would be one example. So...
What is to be gained by a poet taking notes and tracking the planet Jupiter, to use that example?
Well, I think, the view is that there's a way to be a writer, bless you, a way to be a writer, which is to, rather than always foregrounding the first-person emotional state and the eye-centered witness in the world who goes out and sees a dead animal on the beach, and then has this epiphany, and it's relates somehow you're facing your own fragility and death. I mean, that's a legitimate mode, but that's more the epiphany view, confessional poetry. Yes, we're all constantly working out of our own experience and what we witness and see, but to take the emphasis off that first person constant emotional response, I think that can dry up after a certain point. So, the techniques of collage or cut up or, getting beyond the sort of content being the primary push of the poem or the trajectory of the poem. I mean, poems are always going to have content, but the content can be about the process of making the poem. And I'm interested in the rhizome. The rhizome is this tuber structure, a little bit like the internet. The or the Pratitya Samutpada, which is the Sanskrit word for this interconnectedness, and you push something here and something comes up there. And so the Rhizome Project involves this kind of, you know, research and ongoing attention to investigating, you know, areas that you that are not simply your first person personal experience or what you might happen to think or your response or opinion. And for example, I've been working on one long epic poem over 25 years, and it's about 800 pages at this point. And it's very much draws on this investigative research, and it's the content or theme, if there is one, is taking on patriarchy and looking at war. And you know, as somebody born in 1945, feel very much a daughter of the when my father served in Germany and so on and so on. As a child, you know, the implements and the memorabilia he had, you know, just feeling very much coming off when that was the great heroic war. And of course there's a whole downside and another view of the karma of World War II and the kinds of decisions made at that point. And so, you know, tracking, say, war in my time, I have not served, I have not visited war zones. I've been to, you know, difficult zones, but I've never served in a war zone. But taking that on as a kind of investigative project.
Well, I was sort of going back to the science and observation of the planet Jupiter. One of the things that I've noticed in having scientists on the air and reading science is that science yields up incredibly potentially fruitful metaphors that scientists themselves don't seem to be interested in. And yet, when poets take them on, they often don't really know what they're talking about and
exactly.
Make something of the metaphor that is just wrong.
I know. Well, I became very obsessed with neutrinos at one point, which are, you know, the Buddhist particles, because they travel through, they're invisible, and they can travel through things, and they seem to not take up space. They're sort of these egoless particles. And whether that, you know, makes any sense
whether
in terms of the science.
If that's
or
what neutrinos really are or not. Yeah, exactly.
Well, the Dalai Lama goes to these neuroscience conferences, and, I mean, there's a view that, for example, meditative practice can set up these arcs in your neural pathways, and you can actually develop, say, compassion, for example. You know, if you practice empathy, that becomes strengthened in these neural pathways.
Yes.
So it becomes something that becomes more active and real.
Well, I mean, I don't know how far you go, but I think there is a very potentially fruitful collaboration with science that's
absolutely
possible.
But yeah,
it really has to be a collaboration.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I have a close friend who's at Princeton, a neuroscientist, and we've been having a sort of correspondence and conversation.
Now, we're talking to Anne Waldman, who will be at the Center for Contemporary Arts tonight at 7 o'clock, and will also be at the CCA tomorrow at 12 noon. You spoke a moment ago about being inside and outside of institutions, of academic institutions, and I think what you do is kind of on a borderline, because when I was reading through your book, I noticed a lot of issues coming up that I really hadn't thought about in this language since I was in college taking comparative
mm-hmm,
literature
mm-hmm,
classes, so there was
mm-hmm.
a strong reference to academia mm-hmm. in there. So you are both in it and outside.
Well,
I think
it's because we created a Department of Writing and Poetics, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa University, which began as a summer program. And that very first summer, Allen Ginsberg and I went out to Boulder, Colorado. And that particular summer, John Cage was visiting.
What does that mean, disembodied poetics?
Well, the joke was that when we founded the school that summer, we didn't have any, we had nothing. We had an idea. We didn't have a desk. We didn't have stationery. We didn't have a telephone. We didn't have money. And so it was very much on the, you know, we had the inspiration, we had the vision, we had the founder, the Tibetan Buddhist founder of Naropa was very interested that we develop something based in this sort of American alternative poetics. And certainly, I mean, this was the first time Allen Ginsberg had taught or thought, and we thought of, you know, what did this mean to found a poetic school? There was a line of the poet John Ashbery's The Academy of the Future is opening its doors to us. So I think the meditation has been on the Academy of the Future, what that is exactly. And, you know, there was the notion of the Socratic rap. We termed, of course, the Socratic rap. You know, basically a kind of situation where students and faculty can meet in this sort of discourse situation. We've had a track in outreach, so students go into the community. They work in prisons. They work with AIDS patients. They work with the elderly. That's very involved. We have a print shop where you hand on work with small letterpress printing. There's a big emphasis on alternative press and small press work, and there's a wonderful lineage there. So we are not like other writing programs, or your traditional MFA
desks and chairs and paper.
And the students are very empowered, and I myself feel that I've been a student myself there. And then many people gather in these summer situations for a month, and it's the level of discourse, I think, is very interesting. But again, it doesn't, there's less to do with the grading. So, I mean, students are writing theses to do our program. You're creating a book, you're working in performance, you can work in translation, and so on. What you say of the I'm talking to myself in a way, and the meditation on this term, outrider, and I think the difficulty for some of us of a certain generation coming out of the new American poetry and poets who are not so linked up to the academy. It wasn't a career, being a poet was not a career move, and being credentialed and so on. So I think that's the rub and the conundrum and what is sort of worried in this text.
We're going to get Margaret Randall on the phone in just a moment, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to read something of your own work if you would like.
Okay. Well, I thought this is a little tribute to Emma Goldman, who I thought should be invoked in these times. And she began, in her teens, she worked in a corset factory in Russia, so a little reference there. And it's called Corset. What is it to be corset maker, binding the bone and cotton in a daily sweat of labor and purpose? What is it to know the sweat of all you, my sister, workers of daily living, surviving an economic purse string purpose? What is it to be declared the most dangerous of purpose when J. Edgar Hoover has your number? And what is it here now in St. Petersburg, hungry and anxious and soul stirring for surviving my purpose? What is the cause of insomniac passion, my further disillusionment in your systems and your many systems and all the systems that bind the bone in this labor to you who will always profit off the labor of Emma's hands, sewing, binding, aching, toiling, bone and cotton in the class struggle, a dangerous purpose. You want to call it that? Why, you can call it that. And it's so much more, but do call it that. And you will, I'm sure, call it that. And most dangerous of violence and terror, too. And what of a Spanish Civil War? I'll call Wake Up All Minions. I'll call Arise. And would cast in a daily sweat of labor, a struggle, a sweet edge that way, for it's an energy of daily sweat and toil to be free of the fascisms of how and when and why, oh, never free of J. Edgar Hoover, but my imagination ever free of the imagination of J. Edgar Hoover, who will surely, most certainly have your number in his fractious labor and psychopathic toil even now when he, the ghost of fractious J. Edgar Hoover, is stalking, haunting the workplaces, the meeting places, the commune of all my sweat and purpose. What is it to be a large woman bespeckled and intense in my libertarian socialist moment to incite a riot? What is it to be thus called trouble and to be forever unpopular with authorities, to be watched, goaded, arrested, and in lockdown? What kind of terror moment is this? And will it survive and assassinate a president, this kind of moment? Will it survive McKinley? Will it survive psychopathic, fractious J. Edgar Hoover? And will the ghosts of Haymarket stalk the Union Hall still in that old purpose? And will now, sisters, break the corset that binds the moment?
Ann Waldman, thank you so much for being with us. And we will see you tonight at the CCA at 7 o'clock, along with Margaret Randall, who's just going to be on the phone with us in a second. And we'll also see you tomorrow at noon, and you're giving a lecture at the Cinematheque.
Yes, thank you so much.
We're going to take a little break. Stay tuned to KSFR. Joining us now by telephone, I'd like to welcome Margaret Randall. She's a poet, oral historian, essayist, photographer, teacher, and social activist. She's written more than 100 books. Her latest book is Stone's Witness, and she will be joining Ann Waldman tonight at 7 o'clock at the CCA. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be with you.
It's great to have you. Tell us about the title of your book, Stone's Witness. What does that mean? What does that refer to?
Oh, the book is a collection of poems and first-person narratives and 30 full-color photographs, and they all, in one way or another, have to do with identity and place. And in my life, that has had a lot to do with ancient sites, and so the stones are the stones of sites as diverse as Petra and some of our Anasazi sites here in New Mexico and Arizona. So that's what the stones refer to.
There's a line in the book where you say, imagining ways in which the ancient the ancestral Puebloans were different from us, and those in which we may be similar, has become a daily exercise. What does that mean? And again, this is something we talked about with Ann Waldman a few minutes ago. What is the role of the poet versus the scholar archaeologist in this endeavor of imagining ancient Puebloans, for example?
I think as a poet, poets are visionaries, and they think about the past, present, and future in a nonlinear way, as opposed to some of our scientists who think about it in a more linear way. And so I think that that's what that line refers to. Just, you know, the experts tell us very often such and such a people did this or thought that had these kinds of habits or those kinds of habits. And I think more about the individuals, you know, were there people who were different, where there were people who had different ideas and that kind of thing. So,
you mean, like, for example, whether there was dissent within the tribe, that type of thing?
Dissent and just difference of any kind, you know. There is so much difference among us today, and it's what makes us alive and vibrant, and I'm sure that this is true for all ages.
There's a lovely essay in the very beginning of the book where you talk about going to the Metropolitan Museum as a little girl, and there's very much of a sense of childhood memories of art and artifacts in this book. Tell us more about how that has influenced your life's work.
There's a lot of cellular memory in this book, the memory that comes from our cells that is hidden often throughout most of our life. And we have to actually work to retrieve it, because we know that today erasure is one of the big things that power does. Power erases history, it erases memory, both collective and individual. And so there's a lot of that in the book, a retrieval of cellular memory, feelings, glimpses, ideas that come from that kind of knowledge.
And there's also a lot of photography. You've done a bunch of black and white photography for this book. Tell us how that came to be.
Actually, the photographs in the book are in color, and
not in my copy.
you must have one of the copies, the original copies
right,
that were
right.
sent out for review. No, the photographs are in full color, and they are taken in some of these sites, Petra, Machu Picchu, Quetzil, Mesa Verde, and in other places. I mean, there's a photograph, for example, of the fence that exists near San Diego, between San Diego and Tijuana, that divides North and South America. So there are photographs that evoke some of the scenes in the poems.
There's a list of places that you've been to. It says, in my life to date, Nanking, Israel, Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, Palestine, Rwanda, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Darfur, the internal ghettos in our own United States. This is places that you've sought out?
These are not places that I've been to. These are places where travesties, where atrocities have been committed just in my lifetime against great numbers of people, genocides, if you will. And so in that piece, in the narrative that where that list occurs, I'm really talking about the kinds of travesties, of atrocities, of genocides that have been committed against peoples just since I was born in 1936.
What do you do with that? I mean, responding to horror, responding to genocide is the work of all of us, and particularly the work of poets and writers and activists. You've devoted your life to this. How do you deal with it, and how do you give what you know to others?
I think that's one of the big questions today, Mary Charlotte, is how do we deal with it? Because it is so pervasive and so everywhere. And I think people deal with it in different ways. As a writer, as a poet, I often try to deal with it in my work. Other people may deal with it in other ways. I think that we just have to, as poets, we raise consciousness about these events. And we don't want to let our fellow human beings forget. And I think that that is one of my life's works, is to not let us forget.
There is a piece in which you write, at 70, I am the bridge between my parents' lives and those of my children and grandchildren. And you write about that. And then there's this line that really blew my mind, because I wondered what it meant. You said, "Mother takes back her life 4 days before her death." There must be a story there.
Oh, there is a story. My mother died actually at the age of almost 97, almost a year ago this month, the 17th of November. And my mother was a woman who was fearful for most of her life, was highly nervous, was very often unable to decide in one direction or another. And 4 days before her death, she became the woman that I think she was meant to be. And it was very startling for those of us who loved her and were with her during that week. She took absolute command of the situation. She decided how she wanted to die, and she did it with enormous grace.
Did that change your life and that of your children and perhaps grandchildren?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, when loss does change one, and my mother's death, since my father had died 10 years before, my mother's death left me the matriarch, the oldest member of the family, or the oldest member of my generation. And I'm sure that it will also have changed my children and my grandchildren as they continue to live.
Well, we're talking to Margaret Randall, and she is the 2004 recipient of the Penn New Mexico Dorothy Doyle Lifetime Achievement Award in recognition of a lifelong commitment to advocacy of social justice at great personal cost, and also to freedom to write issues in the United States and abroad. And you will be here tonight in Santa Fe at the Center for Contemporary Arts at 7 o'clock, reading and talking about your work along with Ann Waldman. We look forward to seeing you here tonight in Santa Fe. Thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The site is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company tomorrow, Robert Knott will be with us, speaking of the arts. And also, Oscar Munoz will be with us, talking about his work and much, much more on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. We'll see you then. Ciao.